Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark. I'm back with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Before we get to this week's guest, once again, I want to turn people's attention to my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. And there's a bunch of stuff going on there. Number one, I've got over 185 podcasts of really amazing people doing incredible things like my guest today. I would greatly appreciate a ratings and review. It helps with the popularity of the show. And I got to give a lot of love out to everybody that tunes in. Well over 100,000 downloads now, just measured on one source on Apple. I know that you can get them in many other places, Spotify and YouTube and places like that. But really appreciate it. And again, it's not about me. It's about these amazing people telling these incredible tales of survival or how they got to where they are today. As many of you know, I am off to Mount Everest. I'm not sure exactly when this pod is going to run, but we're shooting this today on February 9th, and I do leave for Everest heading into Nepal, Kathmandu, on March 30th. And so these pods will continue to run. It's going to be incredible. It's been a two-year journey, and certainly you can find out a lot of things. There's a button now that says follow the journey. You can hit that button, and there's an actual map that's linked into Garmin, which you can see me going up and down. I will also be blogging from the mountain what is going on real time. We continue to fundraise for Higher Ground. We have a campaign called Amelia's Everest, the Lhotse Challenge. We've blown past our original goal of 27,940. Actually, it was feet originally to match with the dollar amount. And we're pushing past 50,000 now. So, you know, just again, this is not about me. This is about people like my daughter who have epilepsy. Higher Ground serves here in Sun Valley, Los Angeles, and New York. And it helps out many military people with cognitive disorder and adaptive issues that they've had to deal with. Really inspirational to me to even be associated with people like that and my daughter, who continues to inspire me and others. So on that note, let's jump into today's guest. His name is Doug Lewis. This guy is a rock star. Doug, how you doing?
It's great to be here with you. I know we're only about 300 miles away, but I know we both are skinning up the mountain almost every day.
Yeah, you know what? The more I've read about you and the research, I think you and I have a very similar drive, and that is, you know, all out green light and go. And so let me just set this up for the listener right now. So you've got this long career in alpine skiing, mainly growing up in Vermont. And I want to get into that in a few minutes, but kind of the backdrop to all this, which was one of my dreams. And I had an opportunity way back in the day, which is not at your level, but you know, the Olympics are the Olympics, but we're talking to a guy today who actually was on two Olympic teams in 1984 team that was in Sarajevo, and also the 1988 team that participated up in Calgary. So, I mean, I can't even imagine what point in your life, you know, early on growing up in Vermont and going to a ski school, and that's kind of the thing that you guys did. I know it's really cold back there, but where did the light go on for you? Like, someday I want to be in the Olympics. That is my goal.
I've been asked that a lot. And to tell you the truth, I think I can remember when I was 8 years old. I grew up basically on the slopes of the Middlebury College Snow Bowl. My mom was a ski instructor. And if you had caught me and made me stop as I did laps on the lift. At 8 years old, I said, I want to be on the US ski team. I want to be in the Olympics. And what started as this love, I think it started as a love for skiing instilled by my mom and dad. That went into, combined with my competitiveness, I got a win tying my shoes, right? And then I had that big dream. And through all that, I just was hooked, inspired, motivated to push my limits all the way to the Olympics. But it started when I was 8.
That's amazing. And so like you were able to get on the US ski team by the time you were 17, something like that, right? And you end up going to this Green River Valley Ski School, which it sounds like is a very famous ski school, at least it was back in the day, where, you know, they brought a lot of protégés. Like, how do you even get into that school? And did you recognize, or did your parents recognize, that that was kind of the path to success in order to ultimately go to where you wanted to go?
It was all me. My parents wanted me to stay at high school, go to college. They're both Middlebury College grads. It was academics, right? My parents, they're like, you can do this for a while, but it was all driven by me. There was Burke Mountain Academy, Green Mountain Valley School in Stratton. There was three academies. And that was the only way that I knew of. I'd done my research that I was going to find my way, get the training I needed to get onto the US ski team. So I was lucky enough to go to the Green Mountain Valley School. It was only an hour away from my house. So my mom didn't have to say goodbye, goodbye. She could see me in an hour, but it was a boarding school. But every week, all through high school, I had to drive an hour back each week to take my cello lessons because mom wouldn't let me quit the cello. Cello is not a very sexy instrument to play in high school, but she kept me close. But my parents, my mom and dad, let me go and pursue it. They supported me, but they're like, you got to drive the train. And I was happy to floor it and drive the train as fast as I could to the US ski team.
Yeah, I love that. Most people didn't know this about me, but I actually played the violin for 8 years, classically trained. So you and I should have a jam session. Like you said, we're only 350 miles apart. I'm in some valley, you're in Park City. We could form a little virtual band or something, you know, in the string section, which would be cool. So, okay. So you go to the US ski team and when you're on the US ski team, just help me understand this, that the goal is they kind of take the elite of that particular gang and hone your skills, and you guys race around the world, race around the US, and ultimately then you take this group of X, you can fill in the blank. And then of that, then you pare it down. Ultimately, when the Olympics comes, that's everybody's dream, that only so many out of the X amount of people are there, only so many actually get to make the team.
For sure. So the step-by-steps are kind of laid out. No one takes that straight line. You're always failing and taking a new step. But the key is to first get on the US ski team. But that's just the first step. That's not the final step. That's the first step. Then you start training with the best in the US. Then you start competing with the best in the world. And then every 4 years, the Olympics come around. And out of the 10 to 15 downhillers, I was the guy who went straight. I was a speed skier. Out of those 10 to 15, the criteria was you had to have one podium, two top 10s, three top 20s, whatever it is, to qualify for the US ski team. And in 1984, at 20 years old, I got those two top 15s. And I just remember when they told me I was going to the Olympics, it was a feeling of my chest exploding, my heart exploding with joy, and just this singular focus that it's not over yet. This is, again, just another step to being the best in the world. But it's an amazing, amazing feeling, getting that note that you are on your path to achieving your dreams. It gets me nervous right now.
Yeah. You know, look, I took a different path. I was on a football path, and I can tell you for sure that there were multiple people that were way more talented than me. My position was a wide receiver, and the higher you get, the harder it is. And there's a close friend down the street, Mike Hattrip. You may know Mike. And Mike made the US ski team, but he blew his knee out. And, you know, it's just like in the NFL or in college football, guys with so much promise only got so far just because they couldn't keep their body healthy. And it's just an unfortunate thing. But it's just part of staying in the game, not getting disappointed, and things are always evolving and changing.
Yeah, if you go back, so I made the Olympics, my first Olympics at 20. If you go back to when I was 17, my first World Cup was not, I was fast enough, I had qualified, but I weighed 135 pounds. I was 17, and all of a sudden, I was at Aspen for my first World Cup. I ran fourth to last, but it was my day. The TV cameras were shut off. The fans were gone. Probably the podium was already given their medals, but it was my day. So I sat up there and I'm like, this is what I dreamed of, just another steps. And I fire out of the starting gate. I get into my tuck about halfway before I hit Aztec. About halfway down, there's this jump and then just a gentle right footer, left turn. I landed off the jump. Because I was running so late, it was ruddy, so I caught an edge. And at 60 miles an hour, you catch an edge, there was nothing I could do. My skis split, my head hit the ground. Thankfully, I was knocked out because the next thing I hit was a chairlift tower at about 50 miles an hour, and I broke my back. So I come to, my body's all tingly, I'm underneath the chairlift. Luckily, people got me. It was awesome care. But they get me down to the hospital, and this is what goes through the brain of a 17-year-old. I get to the hospital. The doctor comes in, broke your back. We have the x-rays, compressed four vertebrae. You're not going to ski for a while. And I looked at the doctor, and I'm like, okay, there's a race tomorrow. Definitely not racing tomorrow. Next week, probably got to take off. How about the week after that? And the doctor's like, dude, you broke your back. You're not skiing for 8 months. And then I started crying. So the brain of a 17-year-old is amazing because I just was – I'm still on this path. A broken back is nothing. A year, almost to the day after I broke my back, I was in that starting gate again in Aspen with some demons, obviously, because the last time I did a World Cup, I broke my back and fired out, finished, and got through that mental hurdle of coming back from that injury. But with every failure, with every injury, what did I learn? Because that's the key, right? And I learned, number one, I had to manage this risk. I was 110% all the time. I had to manage it. When was I going to pin it? And the second thing is I had to have some physical fitness. So the next year, when I got back to that starting gate, I weighed 25 pounds more. Muscle, mass, core. And luckily, I've had no lasting physical injuries. But that day was integral in getting me to where I needed to go. Luckily, it was one step back, but five steps forward.
I had another buddy of yours on the pod a few weeks ago, Steve Perino, another US ski team guy. And just, he's had this long career working for NBC Sports and calling the different skiing events around the world. And I think he's a partner of yours in that as well. But, you know, we got in this conversation about Lindsey Vonn, and it was interesting because kind of what you had to go through. And I saw this in the NFL as well, is that it's not just about your physical talent, but it's about your mental capacity and maturing that. And in Lindsey's case, for the amount of time she's wiped out at super high speeds that only you know, her ability to come back like it never happened was amazing. Because most people would be favoring a knee, or in your case, your back, or, you know, or it's just like you're having these flashbacks as you're going 89-90 miles per hour down the mountain. I mean, it's insane. I'm a skier, and so I can appreciate those speeds. And there's real stuff. There's chairlifts, right? And I saw a gal, I was skinning up last night, and this gal was snowboarding. He came down. She looked like she was getting lessons. She was going fast, and she went right into the poles of the ski lift. Unfortunately, they're padded, but there's also trees. We've had two people die here this year of trees, you know, because they're going too fast and out of control, and those things don't move. And so, again, I think that mental fortitude that any athlete or anybody trying to achieve something great, when you know there's going to be setbacks, to overcome those things takes a lot of dedication into your craft and what you're trying to do.
For sure. And the higher you go, and you know this, getting to the NFL, the higher you go, it's less about your physical fitness and talent. It's more what's between your ears. The mental side becomes just what separates anybody. Take for the Olympics example. I now cover the Olympics for NBC, and I was in Pyeongchang, and the top 12 athletes, the top 15 athletes in that start on that day can win that race. They're talented enough ski wise. They've done the training, but it's what? It's between their ears is what's going to separate them. Their confidence, their ability to handle stress, their focus, their visualization. I could keep going on. Those are the things that separate champions at the highest level. And you know that because you've been to the highest level, and it's all about that mental side for sure.
Yeah. You know, a guy that I know that we both enjoyed watching this past weekend was the Super Bowl. And I, you know, people are asking, well, who are you rooting for? And I said, Tom. That's who I'm rooting for. Like, it had nothing to do with Tampa Bay. It had all to do with Tom, because I'm an older guy. He's an older guy. And what people, I think, don't quite understand is all the sacrifice he's had to make to do the things that you just said, to create that tunnel of confidence inside your head, to then fortify your body in a way that your ability to perform at a high level goes way beyond maybe what your actual skills are, but you continue to play and play. And, you know, it, for him right now, it doesn't look like there's any slowing down. So it's just, it's remarkable. I saw this thing where like, it was the first time he was on the Stephen Colbert show and he had a strawberry. Like, that was groundbreaking. I throw strawberries in my smoothie every day, but you know, for him, he has a system, but that means you can't go out and party and drink and stay late at night and sleep and rest. And they all matter. And that's the whole key to success in many, there's a lot of things in the ingredients, but it sounds like you had a lot of that in your time. Tell me now what I'm fascinated by, you know, it's Sarajevo, right? What that must have been like being in Europe, that old Eastern Bloc country. It must have just been amazing. And by the way, when you were describing this incident where you were coming down the mountain and you caught an edge and you felt that it was your day, and now, you know, your skis split and your head goes over and you're unconscious and you're flipping and flopping down the mountain. As you're describing that, and for anybody that's old enough to remember, there was the old Wide World of Sports with Jim McKay. And they always say something like the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. And the agony of defeat was that guy. It could have been you, right? Going off a big jump and it was just, you know, train wreck at the end. But that's what it reminded me when you were describing that.
It probably felt like that. Luckily, I was knocked out. So I didn't feel anything for sure. But I'll take you back to Sarajevo. Sarajevo was incredible because it was my first Olympics. I remember driving across the border, across the Iron Curtain. This is 1984. Like, this is USSR. Yeah. This is the big, bad country. And we were going across the Iron Curtain, and they stopped us at the border, and it was classic. It was foggy, maybe a little drizzle. It was midnight. They held us for 2 hours. We didn't know if we were going to the gulag. It was just this classic thing. And then we get through and we're like, oh, we're relieved. We're past this border, and arrived in Sarajevo. And my roommate, Bill Johnson, won the gold medal. I was rooming with the guy who did what I wanted to do. And what he wanted to do was be the best in the world. And Bill, that's a whole nother podcast. We may not have been friends, but we were teammates.
Yeah.
And I learned from him what he did that day to shock the world and win that medal. I learned, and I watched him, and I studied him, and what could I take to bring into my skiing? Wasn't going to be everything. You never copy somebody, but what could I bring in? And a year later, almost to the day, I won my bronze medal at the World Championships, the first ever bronze medal for an American male in downhill. But that experience in Sarajevo, I got 24th, awesome, but also 24th. Yeah. But being close to Phil Mayer and Steve, who won the medals, yeah. Debbie Armstrong won a gold medal there. My roommate won the gold medal. Boy, how lucky was I to be part of that team. And I learned so much from that. And a year later, I won my medal.
So the three people you mentioned, Steve and Phil Mayer and Debbie Armstrong, I'm from Seattle, all from the great state of Washington. So
there you go. Yakima.
Yeah. Well, for Steve and Phil, and then Debbie went to a rival high school of mine. I went to the big high school called Roosevelt. She went to Garfield. So I know the story as well. I was going to ask you though, as you're talking about Bill Johnson, when he came down, I remember that, and he had, there was something there that you, again, brought away from at the table. Like, give me one or two nuggets that you learned that you brought that in that helped you win that bronze medal next year.
I'll split it into two. Number one, skiing wise, the guy was the fastest glider in the world. So he broke down aerodynamics. He studied whether if he covered his buckle with his suit, whether that would be a hundredth faster. So he dug deep into the aerodynamics and skill factor of being a glider. And so I could see that firsthand. Every time we did ski testing or training, I was gliding next to the best glider in the world. So I took that. But more importantly, and we talk about it every time, is the mental thing. And he willed himself. His best skill was his confidence. Nothing was going to get him in his way. He believed to his core he was going to win that medal. And I took that from him because Bill, it's tough to talk about. He's no longer with us. He passed away. But Bill was a tough teammate to have. He tried to get in your head. He would take you out of your mental focus on purpose. That was just his way. So I guess I had to jump through the hurdle of Bill Johnson to get my confidence. And I stood up to him and he respected it finally, but I had to stick my chest and my face right in his face and say, this isn't going to work for me, Bill. I am your teammate. I'm not your enemy. And that was a big move for me to find my confidence by standing up to him. It's tough to talk about. It was a tough relationship.
Yeah, no, I get it. It's interesting too, because, and this is just the way your sport, I would imagine, worked. So when I was going through my football progression, right, and it wasn't so much in Little League and not even maybe a little bit in high school, but really started to kick in college. I went to the University of Washington. So in those days, it was a Pac-10. So you're playing UCLA, USC. And it really kicks in the NFL. And that is the word smack. And there was a lot of guys, you know, in your face, defensive backs. And then when I get to the Raiders, you know, I'm going against Lester Hayes and Mike Haynes every day. And just, you know, in your grill, the stick-em, all the stuff, talking at you. And, you know, since I've been through so much of that, none of that was new to me. But, you know, that didn't change that people were still talking a lot of smack, right? And I can imagine that you've never really dealt with that, because that's not really what they do in skiing in general. You know, people just go, and you guys are so focused on your thing, right? That's what you do. And some guy coming up and getting in your head, I mean, that would just be a hard adjustment if you've never really dealt with that before. Like, and then you're like, you get worked up and you want to fight them, but you know, then that takes you out of your game. Like you said, you know, it's just it's a weird dynamic, you know, and it just really, it's because what I'm trying to describe is because of the vertical that I was in, I was used to that type of thing, right? So the higher I got, it wasn't that big of a deal. There were fights every day on the field, every day on the NFL. It just wasn't uncommon in college. I mean, all the time. And, you know, you guys don't turn around, like, go blow and take your skis and whack each other over the head. It's just a different sport, like tennis, right? It's just
it was for sure different. I've never run into that. I was always the team, the group, and there was Bill. But once I understood him and stood up to him, everything changed. And I took my route and he took his route and we were teammates, maybe not friends, but it's just something you go through. And you just got to find your confidence, believe in yourself. And it's so important to know that you deserve to be there. You know, I was in Sarajevo, Yugoslavia on a chairlift, and you know, it can be overwhelming. You can lose your confidence, but you just got to believe in yourself, especially during those downtimes. It's so important.
Yeah. You know, there's, I wear this, I have it on my wrist right now. I also have this necklace with a key on the end, and I've had it now for years, and it's called Believe. And when you say the word belief, it has so many connotations, but really at the core, if you don't 100% believe that you're going to visualize, which is another thing that you talked about, and see your end goal and then see yourself up on the podium, and maybe my podium is going to be on top of Everest, right? Or I was, you know, the Rose Bowl and the Super Bowl, you know, these other things. If you don't see yourself in those places, it's really hard to get there. It's going to be a grind. And that helps you like blast through all the tough times when, you know, to your point, the adversity comes in when you fall. When you don't, you end up 26 and your goal is first. You know, how do you elevate and how do you get yourself to that next level? Let's move on to Calgary. So, you know, it's hard enough to make one Olympic team, let alone two. And now you make it. I mean, incredible. How was that experience being in Canada? And there are North American neighbors. I've been from Seattle, I've been up in Vancouver, mainly in Whistler many times. But how is that experience in Calgary different from being in the Eastern Bloc of Sarajevo back in the day?
Totally different. I view my Sarajevo experience as the private Olympics. It was so far away that not a lot of the American media went. There was no media. It was like this family. And at 1984, everybody ate in the dining hall. All the athletes stayed on the Olympic Village. Now all the special athletes and the fantastic athletes are on their own apartments. But back in 84, everybody was together. So to me, it's like this hometown private Olympics that I experienced, and it was wonderful. Fast forward 4 years, and it's in Canada, which is pretty much US, and it became media, sponsors, Eddie the Eagle, Katarina Witt. I think it changed to me so much in 4 years. We lost that true sports, and this is back in 84 and 88. It's changed now completely, but we lost that focus on sports. And that was when the media and the sponsors and the different aspects of the Olympics started sneaking in. So it was really a different experience. Really interesting.
So when I got done playing in the NFL, like a lot of guys, you go through this big adjustment. We'll call it that. Right. And you've been doing this one thing for all your life. It's been your one drive, your one passion. And then all of a sudden you can't do that thing anymore. NFL has gotten so much better about providing programs. They've got people in charge back in New York of rolling out, I mean, it's almost daily now, of educational resources, anywhere from health to you want to coach, you want to be in broadcasting, you want to become a financial analyst, all those things. So there's a great like pathway towards and a bridge towards somebody making it to the other side. But for you back in the day, what was that like in terms of, I call it life after football, but life after skiing? What was that like for you?
It was the toughest 2 years of my life. When I retired, I lost myself. I lost my identity. I've talked to a lot of people about it. It's like you mourned a death, the mm-hmm. death of you as a ski racer. You're mourning that. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who I was. I was in Sports Illustrated, and then I was a freshman in University of Vermont. I was the golden boy, and then I was nothing. And it was really, really tough. And it took 2 years to get through it. The struggle for me was everybody told me, you should go into broadcasting. You got to be an investment banker. You got to do this. You got to do that. And I was listening to them and trying, what should I do? What should I do? But what happened finally was I had to listen to my heart. And so took me about 2 years, but I got hired to coach these U10s on the ski hill. So I was going on the weekend and skiing around with 8 and 9 year olds. And all of a sudden I found my passion. That's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to be on Wall Street. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I didn't want to do these other things. I just wanted to inspire and educate the next generation of athletes. And then something woke, the light went on, because once I had a goal, once I had a passion, I knew what to do. You work hard, you set your goals, your intermediate goals, you ask questions, just like I did in skiing. But those 2 years, I was completely lost because I didn't know who I was. And I'm so glad the NFL has the help. The U.S. ski team and the USOPA, USOPC, now has some great programs, but in 1988, it wasn't available. And I was floundering for a while, but I got through it. Yeah, and I've since had to do that. You know, I've changed careers and changed things 3 or 4 times. And now I can believe in myself that I just got to find my new passion and then everything's easy.
Yeah. I mean, look, I was a hot mess too, you know, and with no resources. And I think it was about 2 years, and, you know, things are going fine now, but there's no question it's taking and rechanneling that same energy that you had to become great at whatever your thing was and rechannel, pivot, and go in this new direction. And that's really the key to success. I see nobody else can see this, but I can see this. I also have it down in my notes that one of the things that you've done, which is really cool, and I think I might be too old for it, but these Elite AM fitness camps that you do... Tell me about that.
It's called Elite Team. We thought it was the coolest world. It's Elite with the AM, or it's Eli Team, but it's Elite Team. It's a combo word. And so once I figured out I wanted to inspire and educate the next generation, I wanted to save them a lot of the trouble that I went through, all those mistakes. So basically, if you look at me, I'm 5'8". I'm one of the tiniest guys who ever did World Cup skiing. The most I ever weighed was 180 pounds. Now you have to be 200 pounds and 6 feet. If you've ever stood next to Lindsey Vonn or Michaela Schifrin or Bode Miller, these guys are massive. They're specimens. So I was always the tiny guy and I had to make up for it. So to me, the key to my success was being a complete athlete. Sure, I was an awesome skier and I trained, but I had the focus of sports nutrition, sports physiology, and sports psychology. So those are our three founding steps is sports physiology, sports psychology, and sports nutrition. So I've spent the last 30 years trying to educate kids that, sure, it's about skiing or how good you are as a passer or catching the ball or hitting the baseball, but it's all that other stuff that makes a champion. So it's been really fun to educate kids how to eat, why you want to eat. If you're a football player, it's anaerobic, so you got to eat more carbs. If you're a long distance runner, you want to eat more healthy fats. So the nutrition aspect, the sports physiology, why do you need to be strong? Why do you need to have a good cardiovascular base? Why do I need mobility? So that's that sports physiology start. But most important, as I've said, is that sports psychology. You have to, confidence is a skill. Focus is a skill. Visualization is a skill. Just like all those football skills or soccer skills. And so that's what I do. I try to make these athletes a more complete athlete so they can handle everything. I'll let the ski coaches coach them on skiing, but I'll coach them in everything else.
And I assume this is down in Park City.
It's everywhere. I've done a lot of camps in Vermont. We have them in Park City, but now we had to pivot because of COVID. We have an online program so they can log on and get their workouts and learn about focus and do it all. And it was a scary pivot, as everybody did in COVID. But we had 500 kids sign on over the summer, and we're just going to keep building that program.
That's great. That's great. So like any true and great journalist, I'm really not putting myself in that category, but I called your buddy Steve Perino. I said, give me some dirt on this guy. And here we go. And he goes, you want to ask him about rookie night at Rookie Rock, which is someplace in Austria. I don't know anything about this other than he said, you know, tee that thing up.
Okay, so this is great. So Steve Perino was my teammate on the US ski team, and then I sat next to him at NBC for the last 8 years as I'm the analyst. He's the play-by-play. So Steve and I go way back. So Steve was talking about rookie night. So I'm sure they had this in football and every sport, but to bond as a team, the men's speed team, we had this thing called the rookie night. And so we'd, you know, just pick on the younger racers, and I was a rookie for sure. And then I moved up to be a vet. But the reason you become a rookie, or the way you become transfer from a rookie to a vet, is you race out Kitzbühel. Kitzbühel is this crazy, the most dangerous, challenging downhill course in the world. And it's in Austria. It's called the Strife. So as soon as you go out of the starting gate of Kitzbühel and get to the finish, that's the asterisk, you have to actually finish, you transfer from a rookie to a vet. Okay. Quick story about Steve Perino. I don't think he told you this on his podcast, is Steve Perino was at the start of Kitzbühel. He was there to become a vet. He was racing Kitzbühel. And three or four people crashed in front of him, Americans, got hurt. And Steve Perino picked up his skis, walked back to the lift, and took the lift down and decided not to race that race. And people give him I give him a lot of crap for that, right? But it's probably the smartest thing he ever did, because you can die. I mean, people were getting hurt, and Steve was mature enough and smart enough and scared enough. He said, no, I'm out. And so I never let him forget that, which is fine. But so that's how you become a veteran on the US ski team. Now the rookie rock, we found a rock that weighed like 25 pounds and we awarded it to the rookie of the team for that year. And he had to carry that rock with him in his backpack up to the course, down to the hotel, and the whole year. So that was the rookie rock. And it passed to generation and rookie to rookie. And it was an awesome story. But that's that camaraderie that works in a team atmosphere.
Yeah, that's awesome. So the, one of the reasons why I know that you're certifiably crazy is because you actually participated in a depth race in 2007 and you won the damn thing. I've seen this on video. I've seen it on YouTube. It's crazy insane. What would drive you ever to want to be? First of all, describe for the listener what this thing is.
It's indescribable. We don't have enough time, but the death race does not have a start time and it doesn't have a finish time. You don't know what you're going to do. You are just thrown challenges. The problem is, I thought it was just, they called it the death race. I'm like, whatever. If I get to run and do some obstacles, I'll be psyched. I never ran for 13 hours. I had to put a wheelbarrow together and wheelbarrow 50 pounds of sand, a tire, and a bunch of tools 15 miles through the woods. And then you had to dive into ponds and get cinder blocks. And then you had to saw wood and move dirt. And it was the, I can't even describe it. Just think of the craziest thing that people can think of. And they made you do it. And this was the inaugural one. And 13 hours later, there was only three finishers. Everybody else quit. And I was somehow able to win it. And I instantly retired. They kept doing the death race, but I'm like, I'm done with this for sure. So I am in, I've always been into someone pushing my limits. I set these goals and I learned early to set goals, these big goals, these North Stars that keep you pointed in the right direction, climbing all seven summits, going to Everest. To me, that's crazy, right? But I'm not afraid to set those goals. And then the second part is most important. And I tell the kids this, everybody dreams, right? But you got to make it a real goal by committing. And committing, the best way I can describe it is you feel it in your gut. You feel it in your heart. You feel it in your entire body when you want something so bad that you will commit everything to it. And whether you get there or not, it doesn't matter. But that commitment, as I tell these young athletes, that's what separates champions. Because the champions love to do the nasty stuff. They love to struggle because it's part of that commitment to that goal that they want to get to. So I am now just like you, trying to find the next goal. I'm into running 100 milers now. I just finished my third one. I've signed up for a 100 miler in Switzerland in August that has 37,000 vertical over the 100 miles. So that's my next challenge. And I just love, I love being a part of pushing myself outside of my comfort zone. And for those of you listening who may not like that, I bet you do. Just start with a 5K, then go to a 10K. You don't have to do 100 miles like me. Just do whatever gets you out of that comfort zone and makes you alive. And that's what I love. That's what I live for.
Yeah. And one of the things that you just said, which I really identify with, is commitment. And I can say this with all sincerity, while somebody may not end up on the U.S. ski team, the Olympic team like you did, or playing the NFL. Really, the only difference between myself and what we're doing now, you two, is that I just don't quit. You don't quit. And the people that get out there and they make a big goal on the 31st of the end of the year, and then by February or March, you know, they're out. And that's the only difference. I just keep going, and the others are like, yeah, I just don't feel like getting out of bed today. You know, whatever the case may be. And I'm not special, but I've made a commitment because of that passion, because of that drive. And you're doing the same type of stuff. And anybody can do that. And it can be like knitting. It can be making a table. It doesn't have to be running or doing something physical, but it's staying with the commitment and taking it to the other end. That is the key to success in so many things. Man, you've got some great stuff going on. You've lived a great life. You have, and this is really the thing I like about you and your story the most, is that even though I've asked you a lot about it, you don't seem like a guy to me that spends a lot of time looking in the rearview mirror on all the things you've accomplished, because there's so much ahead of you and what you want to go do. And you know, get across that finish line in Switzerland and climb 37,000 feet. And then you'll do that and then you'll come off it and go, okay, now what can I do next? Right. So you're always like pushing yourself and you're looking out there. And it's just, I think it's so inspirational and such a great message to everybody about goal setting, you know, sticking to it, belief, a lot of words that you use today, commitment, going after it, sticking with it. And then it doesn't matter if you're first or the last place, you will win because you actually did that. And that's all that matters.
For sure. People think it's always about that goal. I'm setting that goal just to set my path and to motivate and energize. I may not get to it. First time I've run the rim to rim to rim, across the Grand Canyon and back, and I made it, but it was the second time. I fail all the time. I got all the way across, 25 miles across, and my IT band was hurting, and it was a tough decision, but I'm like, I'm doing the smart thing. I'm going to quit. I had to call my wife up, who was on the South Rim. I was now at the North. She had to drive 6 hours around to pick me up. That was the worst call I've ever done. But I fail all the time. And that's really not the most important part. The most important part is you set that goal, you commit just like you have, and you go for it. And every day that you step forward to that goal it makes me alive. And I've been trying to help people find that in themselves my whole life.
There you go. Finding your summit, about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Where can people find you?
It's that weird name, ELITEAM, eliteteam.com. I'm sure you can Google Doug Lewis, but yeah, Elite Team is the best way. And you can see me on NBC. Hopefully I'll be in China covering the Olympics. Elite Team coaching kids or skiing on the mountain.
Love that. Love that. Okay, man. I so appreciate you coming on the pod. This 45 minutes just flew by, and you're a good guy, and you're, you know, the planet really needs more inspirational, positive people like yourself to make it a better place. And I appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you very much. And you're doing something that I could only dream about. So good luck with Everest. I'll be watching.
I will. Thank you. I'll need it. There he is. The one, the only Doug Lewis. Thank you.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.